The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled Ecuador's Gold by Heidi Brandes. Can the most coveted chocolate in history help revive forests around the world? Of all the heirloom cacao pods laid before us on a rickety wooden table on this quiet hillside outside the city of Manta in Ecuador, the ancient variety known as Nacional was misleadingly plain. It was hard to believe the shriveled yellow pod contained one of the world's rarest and most coveted cacao beans. Then I tasted its fruit in its fresh, raw, pure form. The flesh is peachy and bright, with a fragrant and sugary bouquet. And the beans, once roasted and hand-ground into a thick paste, give off a rich scent of pure dark chocolate that becomes almost overpoweringly seductive. Servio Pichard, one of the world's foremost cacao experts, combined the paste in a metal bowl with sugar and other ingredients, his jaunty straw hat dipping over dark eyes. He gave a smile when the sugary chocolate, served in a shot glass, touched my tongue. I think I might have moaned in pleasure. I had never tasted chocolate like this, smooth and silky, yet almost supernaturally bold in its flavor. I could understand why this fateful breed of chocolate had made chocolatiers swoon for generations, and why some modern-day chocoholics are willing to fork over several $100 for a single bar. Scholars estimate that Nacional was first cultivated more than 5,000 years ago in what is now the Zamora Chinchipe province, and ancient traders planted these Nacional trees near the coast. A 2012 study found that European colonists began planting Nacionales themselves in the New World roughly a century after Columbus. The variety soon attained a global reputation for its strong aroma. Ecuador's integration into the world economy in the 19th century was almost entirely dependent on the cocoa trade. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, its popularity exploded as chocolate became a craze in Europe. In Hamburg, Germany, then the center of the global cocoa trade, Nacional was particularly prized. Then, in 1916, a blight called frosty pod rot ravaged cacaos, including Nacionales, and in 1919, the witch's broom disease was thought to have finished off Nacional trees for good. Cacao yields in Ecuador plummeted, and growers introduced new hybrid and foreign varieties. The Nacional, with its distinctive and celebrated flavor, seemed to be a thing of the past, the dodo bird of the chocolate world. But in 2011, to the astonishment of the world, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Agricultural Research Service, in collaboration with Fortunato Chocolate, an American-founded company based in Peru, announced it had identified cacao trees in Peru that had ancient Nacional DNA. While Ecuador was the center of the Nacional trade in the 18th and 19th centuries, Peru also boasted some of these precious trees. Now a partnership between local growers and Ecuador's ecological preservationists is pulling this legendary cacao variety back from the brink of extinction. We call it the Noah's Ark of ancient Nacional cacao, says Jerry Toth, the 45-year-old co-founder of the Third Millennium Alliance, TMA, a conservation nonprofit, and the co-founder of Toac Chocolate, a private company that creates organically grown, top-of-the-line chocolate using Ecuadorian cacao grown by local farmers. More than 30 families are now working with Toth to reforest their lands using seedlings from the nearly extinct tree. The rebirth of this once-lost treasure isn't just a miracle for the chocolate-loving world. It's also a milestone in reviving the rich heritage of Ecuador's coastal forests and farming. And it may even offer hope for saving other endangered trees worldwide. Toth wasn't looking to rediscover a lost species when he co-founded TMA in 2007. His aim was simpler, to reforest degraded land. The Illinois-born conservationist, a graduate of Cornell University and the London School of Economics, relocated to Ecuador in 2006. While researching methods to sustainably reforest the mountains of Ecuador's Pacific coast, depleted by logging and deforestation, TMA determined that cacao trees were ideal for their shade tolerance and revenue potential. To support himself financially, Toth co-founded Toac in 2013 with Carl Schweizer, an Austrian colleague, and Denise Valencia, a native of Quito, to make a 21st century brand from Nacional Cacao. Toac is a portmanteau of earth and tree from two indigenous Ecuadorian languages. I was like, I can start a company that really focuses on cacao to the point at that point of origin and take it to a really high level of chocolate. And I can do with chocolate what wine has been doing to grapes for a long time, Toth says. Accordingly, he aimed to mimic the world's most discerning vintners who prize the purity of old-growth heritage vines. So Toth set out to find some old-growth cacao trees, and no one knew more about old-growth in Ecuador than Servio Pichard. Pichard is a fourth-generation cacao grower and a member of the Seed Guardians Network, an alliance of families working to save heirloom seeds of all kinds in Ecuador. He's also been informally advising TMA since its inception. When Toth told Pichard he wanted to find the oldest cacao trees in the country, Pichard immediately recommended the remote valley of Piedra de Plata, where he'd seen old-growth trees as a child. Ancient, gnarled things that carried the visible weight of age. Toth had heard farmers recalling the legend of Nacional Cacao with deep pride. So when Pichard said he thought he might be able to lead Toth to several Nacional cacao trees tucked up in the Piedra del Plata that had survived the blights, Toth was intrigued. Pichard believed these trees might be the last surviving ancient Nacionales in coastal Ecuador. Toth and Schweizer joined Pichard on a trek to Piedra del Plata to meet with growers who showed off cacao trees planted by their grandfathers and great-grandfathers before the arrival of the diseases thought to have wiped out the trees in the early 1900s. It was a long and sweltering hike through tangles of undeveloped coastal forest. Toth and Schweizer hoped the difficult journey would pay off. Perhaps in part because of the valley's isolation from the rest of the country, these trees survived the epidemics and may have become resistant to the blight that killed off so many of their brothers, Toth said. When the expedition reached the trees looked right, so Toth and Schweizer decided to put them in the test in a laboratory. The pair partnered with the Heirloom Cacao Preservation Fund and Freddy Amores, a scientist at INIAP, the Research Institute of Ecuador's Ministry of Agriculture, to analyze the DNA of 47 trees they found in Piedra de Plata. To their delight, 9 proved to be 100% pure ancient nacional, likely the only ones known in the country. The world's greatest chocolate was alive in Ecuador. But a new problem presented itself. These nacionales at Piedra de Plata were at least 100 years old and approaching the end of their lifespan. Most would soon die, And a few at this age would even be able to reproduce. Like, they're ridiculously old, Toph says. So in 2018, TMA established an outdoor genetic bank nearby in the 2,000-plus-acre Yamakokwe Reserve in Manabai, where seedlings can thrive. Working with the Agriculture Polytechnic School of Manabai, TMA began replicating ancient Nacional trees through a process known as grafting. The Yamakokwe Reserve land already had some heirloom cacao planted decades ago. So TMA transplanted ancient Nacional stems onto the rootstock of those heritage trees to create clones of the rare trees. TMA successfully planted 189 clones within a special parcel of the Yamakokwe Reserve that was protected from cross-pollination from other cacao varieties. Cross-pollination would muddy the pure genetic waters, and TMA and TOAC wanted to retain the purity of Nacional. Toth's goal was having all of those 189 reproduce, sprouting their coveted yellow or orange pods. In the end, nearly all of them did so, and those that initially did not were regrafted or replanted. TMA continues to distribute their offspring to any local cacao grower who wants to help save this historic variety from extinction by creating a suitable market for Nacional. To build up their success for the next generation, TMA is also training a group of farmers in their 20s in the nearby community of Camarones to become grafting experts themselves. With careful grafting, Toth predicts that within 3 years, these young trees will provide enough cuttings to reproduce up to 5,000 pure Nacional seedlings each year. Although farmers in Manabai have long expressed pride in the legacy of Nacional, newer hybrid cacao varieties produce higher yields much more quickly. So getting farmers to cultivate the ancient seedlings, Toth knew, would require financial help to offset potential losses from a slower-growing, less fruitful crop. Accordingly, TOAC pays at least 3 times the standard market rate for hybrid Nacional cacao, and TMA pays additional bridge payments of $11,000 per acre over 5 years to farmers who agree to grow ancient Nacional and hybrid Nacional cacao, which produces less expensive but still exalted chocolate. In turn, TOAC has become famous for producing some of the most expensive chocolate on the market. In one case, $490 for a single 1.76-ounce bar. That big-ticket bar and other confections of Nacional are available online at TOAC's website and through specialty retailers like Harrods and Caputo's. Cacao growers here in Ecuador are used to being promised a lot of things from political groups, from the government, from private institutions, Switzer says. Most of the time, they would be let down and become disappointed and frustrated. Not so with the cacao project. Veronica Vaca, a farmer in Camarones, was among the growers to take TMA up on the challenge. "Everything is growing really well because we're giving the trees a lot of attention," she says. "Having a company that we will know buy our cacao at a really good price makes me feel confident about it." Mariana Ortiz, another farmer for Camarones, says the quality speaks for itself. "We want to continue planting Nacional cacao because of the aroma and because of how good it is," Ortiz says. He adds that the farmers will keep planting so that Nacional doesn't fall away. TMA developed a plan to divide its plantings. 80% would be newer hybrids and 20% ancient Nacional. Today, each participating farm receives regular seedlings of this precious heirloom cacao variety. Currently, 38 families are part of the program. The plan is to scale up to 200 farmers over the next 2 years. TMA oversees the management of the plants, provides the land, performs the grafting, and distributes seedlings to farmers. But TOAC delivers another key element, offering a guaranteed market for the final product. Meanwhile, TMA continues to work on its broader goal, reforestation, particularly along Ecuador's ecologically delicate coast. In addition to planting cacao trees, TMA has been reintroducing and cultivating a wide variety of other fruit trees and native trees on depleted agricultural lands, forming the basis of the organization's regenerative agroforestry program. Farmers working with TOAC receive, per acre, around 296 native shade tree seedlings, 1,482 cacao seedlings, and 741 banana cuttings in the first year. In the second year, they get replacements for any seedlings that didn't take. The growers can sell dry nacional for roughly $7,300 per metric ton, more than twice the global median for cacao. After covering the cost of harvest and transport, TOAC reinvests in the program and then pays 83% of the gross directly to farmers. "We are trying to replicate a forest," Toth says. "This is more than cacao. It is regenerative ag forestry." The success of the TMA Genetic Seed Bank gives hope to those seeking to preserve other endangered tree species the world over. There are now more than 840 seed banks around the globe. And in the last year in the United States, President Joe Biden issued an executive order that emphasized the critical role of old-growth trees in reforestation and climate mitigation efforts across the country, while directing his secretaries of the Interior and Agriculture to complete a full survey of old-growth forests on federal lands. Other chocolatiers are catching on, too. Already, TMA has two other companies expressing interest in purchasing the resulting ancient nacional cacao: Mindo Chocolate Makers of Michigan and Nicoa, an Ecuadorian company. "I don't think we will have a problem selling it," Toth says. As for how people beyond Ecuador can help the ongoing resurrection of the world's favorite chocolate, Toth says this problem has a surprisingly bite-sized answer. Just eat it. Even if you can't afford the $490 TOAC bar, the company has more modest options, and other chocolatiers in Ecuador beginning to use nacional varieties and more affordable blended products. It shouldn't be a hard thing to ask people. Eat, become connoisseurs of really good chocolate. Now we'll move on to an article from Prologue, National Treasure, Life in the Fast Lane, by Elena Scher. Before he changed aviation forever, Glenn Curtis achieved an unparalleled speed record on land. The 1907 Curtis V8 looks like it went fast. It suggests a lifetime of high speed, as if the very wind had cocked the forks back, swept its handlebars out like streamers, even smoothed and elongated its frame. Other motorcycles of the age, like the early Harley-Davidsons and Triumphs, look more like bicycles, with jaunty upright handlebars, cheerful enamel paint jobs, and compact motors offering single-digit horsepower. The Curtis, by contrast, looks vicious. Satin black, ears back with 8 fin cylinders churning out 40 horsepower, a big dog ready to bite. The engineer and racer Glenn Curtis wasn't intimidated by the machine he designed when he threw a leg over it and throttled out across the hard-packed sand of Ormond Beach, Florida, in January 1907. But then, Curtis wasn't intimidated by much. At 20 years old, he was already known in newspapers as the Hell Rider for his aggressive moves on the track. Off two wheels, though, Curtis was a calm and even cautious man, who saw racing primarily as a way to prove the worth of his engine designs. He began manufacturing his own motorcycles in 1902 and set his first speed record the next year. But his lightweight and powerful engine soon caught the eye of early aviators, and Curtis would eventually become known for his work as a pilot and airplane designer. At the start of 1907, he was beginning to customize his engines with flight in mind. The big V8 in his motorcycle was initially built for an airship customer, but Curtis and his team couldn't resist a chance to run it on the ground. The officials at the Florida Speed Carnival, the land speed competition where Curtis first proposed test racing his 8-cylinder monster, were less enthused about the experiment and disqualified the oversized and over-engine machine as too powerful to run in any of the official classes. After the official carnival ended, though, Curtis and his crew were allowed to set up the V8 bike for an exhibition run with a 2-mile start so he could get up to speed. Official, unofficial, none of that mattered to Curtis. He simply wanted to know what his machine could do. What it did, he found, was turn the landscape to brush strokes in his vision as he shot past, the crowd to a dark smudge against the gray sand. Left miles behind in mere seconds. Hunched over the tanks, Curtis covers his time mile in just over 26 seconds, reaching a speed of 136 miles per hour before he let up and engaged the brake. It took him another mile to bring the bike to a halt. The accepted rules of the day required a return run to qualify for the record. Here, Curtis's beast finally bit him. Under the strain of such speed, the U-joint that connected the drive shaft to the wheel broke off, partly buckling the frame and narrowly missing hitting bits of its rider as broken parts whipped around Curtis's feet. He was unharmed, but the run seemed to have quenched his desire for land-based adventure. Riding an 8-cylinder motorcycle is not likely to become very popular, Curtis said afterward, with characteristic understatement. Curtis may have been casual about the experience, but the incredible speed made headlines, earning him the media title of the fastest man on Earth. It was true. At the time, no train, car, bike, or plane had achieved such a velocity. His 2-wheel record almost outlived him, lasting until 1930, the year of his death at 52. Curtis's next adventures would take him into the sky. As an engineer and then as a pilot, he made contributions in design and technique that helped establish the airplane's place in both commercial and military use. It's no coincidence that both the Curtis and the Wright brothers began on 2 wheels and moved to the heavens. The early 1900s saw a melding of human imagination and mechanical development that gave us new speed on land and in the air. Both Curtis and the Wright brothers grew up in the same world of wonder with technology, says Jeremy Kinney, lead curator for the National Air and Space Museum's recent Nation of Speed exhibition. American Aviation, Kinney says, all comes back to this V8 engine on the motorcycle. Curtis died young, after complications during an appendectomy, but his name lives on. In 1929, his aviation firm had merged with that of the Wright brothers to create the Curtis Wright Corporation, which immediately became the largest aviation firm in the United States and still supplies airlines and governments around the world. The pursuit of speed on land continues. Rocky Robinson holds the current world speed record for motorcycles. He's gone 376 miles per hour while riding the Top 1 ACK Attack, at first glance, a totally different animal from the Curtis's V8. Robinson's bike is powered by 2 Suzuki Hayabusa engines, turbocharged for a combined 1,000 horsepower. The bike looks almost like a rocket, the driver belted in, wrapped in a fireproof suit, and tucked in an enclosed cockpit. But Robinson says the experience on course is largely unchanged. In land speed circles, we all know Curtis. He's the grandfather that started this stuff. It's all his fault. Move on to one final article about QWERTY by Nick Yetto. Typecasting, spelling out the genesis of one of history's most indelible inventions. In 1866, Christopher Latham Sholes, a Wisconsin newspaper publisher and former state senator, co-invented an automated machine to number coupons and tickets, a task previously done by hand. When Sholes unveiled his design to a fellow inventor, Carlos Glidden, Glidden had an idea, exclaiming, "Why can't you make a machine that will print letters as well as figures?" Sholes shared Glidden's enthusiasm, as did S.W. Sewell, a Milwaukee printer, so the three of them set up shop on State Street by the Milwaukee River and began working on what would become the world's first commercially successful typewriter, though Sewell didn't stick around for long. Sholes and Glidden's first prototype had a semi-sequential keyboard layout, with all letters uppercase and the capital I doing double duty as a 1. 3579 NOPQRSTUVWXYZ 2, 4, 6, 8, period, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M. There's some dispute over how and why Scholes and Glidden arrived at the QWERTY layout. That's Q-W-E-R-T-Y. Some historians have argued that it was solved a jamming problem by spacing out the most common letters in English. Others, particularly more recent historians, hold that it was designed specifically to help telegraphists avoid common errors when transcribing Morse code. Regardless, after around 30 test models, Scholes and Glidden settled on QWERTY and changed the world. The Scholes and Glidden typewriter came to market in 1874, manufactured by E. Remington and Sons, which was then expanding its offerings after a lucrative spell manufacturing firearms for the Union. Sold as the Remington No. 1, it became the first commercially successful typewriter and influenced nearly every subsequent successful design. Now, even non-publishers could exchange chicken-scratch penmanship and sloppy inkwells for precise, easy-to-read type, speeding business, legal, medical, and personal communications. Throughout all subsequent revolutions, IBM's Selectric typewriter, introduced in 1961, the first personal computers in the 1970s, the first keyed BlackBerry in 1999, the market dominance of touchscreen phones and tablets in the early 2010s, QWERTY has remained key, even if the keys are no longer hooked to swinging type bars. Our children learn to type this way because their ancestors did, going back 150 years and counting. In 1925, the columnist Marion Talman counseled a reader seeking a good, affordable typewriter. "You want to make sure it's of standard make," she responded. "Look and see if the upper row of letters begins with Q-W-E-R-T-Y. If so, you are all right." We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138.